I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, is Europe's single market in reality just an idea that is now actually dead in the water? Well, two leading Financial Times journalists explain their thinking on that. We look at some of the eye-watering amounts of money involved in the Netflix and now Paramount bids to take over Warner Brothers. Plus,
the boys of the NYPD choir were singing going by.
Yes, it's Christmas time, and we take an economic tour of Christmas from the Irish to the Great Wall of China. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, ordinarily, I go straight into an explainer at this point in the show, but this week, I was reading through the Fed interest rate announcement about dropping the US interest rate, and I thought there are so many terms in here that have been part of my explainers over the past few months, including the dot plot, the hawks and the doves, the dual mandate of the US, etc. So here's a quick revision session. The Fed, which is the central bank in America, has a dual mandate, which is to both achieve full employment and maintain price stability. The dot plot at the moment is at a historic level because it shows the expectations of people who make decisions about Fed rates. And it's clear that we have a lot of division there between the doves, who want to cut interest rates faster to stimulate the economy, and the hawks, who want to hold interest rates as they are or increase them to manage inflation. So in summary, right now, the dot plot shows a lot of division between the hawks and the doves, depending on which side of the dual mandate they feel is more important. Now,
Techscape on Taking Stock with the all-new Renault 4. Stylish and versatile. A high-tech take on the classic. Rethink Renault.
Well, streaming giant Netflix announced last week that following a bidding war, it was set to acquire film industry giant Warner Brothers along with its streaming and cable businesses. However, the announcement has ricocheted through the film industry and polarised cinema purists against streaming lovers. So on Monday, Paramount Studios turned the whole action into a blockbuster after it announced it would be bidding for the sole ownership of Warner. Now, the future of all three companies lies uncertain as heavyweight lawyers, the Directors Guild of America and the US President himself gets involved. Joining me today is producer of Taking Stock, presenter of Screen Time and the best film buff that I know. It's John Fardy. John, I've been waiting a long time to interview you now, so I'm really...
It's a Christmas present.
Absolutely. Buckle up. So, first up, let's look at the Netflix side of the business before we get into the deal. So I went through the most recent earnings call and it says that it only has 7% of the addressable market in terms of consumer spending, 10% of the time spent on TV in its biggest markets, and its current programming is for an audience of a billion people. So where does the Netflix business stand today in terms of market share? Because that's what this is all about.
Yeah, but the market share, who's getting the rest of that market share?
Well, it is saying TV time, obviously the traditional side of things there. It has competitors too in terms of Amazon Prime and Disney Plus, etc.
All of those people have a lower market share. So the people they're fighting against is terrestrial TV and also YouTube and things like that. But, and I should say at the outset, I am no apologist or, you know, on the books of Netflix at all, right? But they have won the streaming wars thus far. They still have huge ground to make up, it would seem, when you look at the market share. But in terms of all the other players, in terms of streaming, they are winning. They still have first mover advantage by a long shot. But it dovetails into the story because their proposed acquisition of Warner was an attempt to get more of those eyeballs.
Okay. And just before we get right into the deal, though, can I just get an understanding of who their competitors are? I put forward who I would consider the traditional ones.
Yes.
But one would also argue that it could be YouTube. It certainly could be TikTok.
Yeah.
It could be sleep.
Yes, absolutely. So the thing is, how do you define market share. Now, you know a bit more about this than me, but so who are all those people they're getting? Occasionally they are asleep. Occasionally they are watching TikTok. Occasionally they are watching YouTube. But when it comes to Amazon, Disney Plus, HBO Max, which they may be about to buy, Paramount Plus, they are definitely winning that. But yes, there is room for growth they maintain. But at a certain point, there will reach a saturation point. I mean, there is only going to be so many people, you know, in any marketplace that will want to watch TV. You know, there is still a cohort of people in Ireland who claim not to own a TV. I forget what the percentage is, but the last time I checked, it was something like 7%, you know. So they are winning the streaming wars. They have miles yet to go before they sleep, to quote Robert Frost. But, you know, there is a limit to how much they can go, but we haven't reached that by any stretch of the imagination. There are still, as Ted Sarandos would see it, billions of eyes to convert.
So, at this point now, we have an understanding of, say, the Netflix business itself, the fact that there's lots and lots of room to run. And let's introduce the development that we saw last week, which is an $82.7 billion bid for Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Now, if we look at the strategic direction where Netflix wants to go, This, I'm quoting this directly from the earnings call, it says, it sounds super simple, but building a real at-scale global streaming business is hard because you've got to combine great tech product and great content from all around the world. Mm. Like, it sounds like Warner Brothers would simply accelerate that. So it does make sense.
Absolutely, it does make sense. And you see, what I suppose Netflix don't have, which seems kind of strange to say about the king of the streamers, is legacy titles. So for instance, if they take over Warner, they are going to have The Sopranos. And in a way, and we don't have time to get into this, but I have a theory that the whole nature of TV changed when The Sopranos came along, because that wasn't so much a TV show. It was a mega movie that happened to be shown over 10 years in serial form. And ever since then, TV has changed dramatically. And I don't think we would have Netflix in the current form if it wasn't for something like The Sopranos. I'm getting slightly off point though. So when they take over Warner, they will have HBO Max, which has things like The Sopranos. They will have legacy TV, but they will also have legacy brands like Batman, right? So for people who don't know, Warner don't release huge amounts of movies, but the ones that they do tend to be huge. So they own the DC franchise. So if you look at Disney, for instance, they bought Star Wars, and that has been an untold success. The viewer hasn't always won out. It has occasionally with things like The Mandalorian. It hasn't with shows like Boba Fett and stuff like that. And in case you're not a Star Wars fan, what Disney have done, many would say, and I partially agree, is plunder the Star Wars universe, because it was this hugely popular series of movies from the 80s. So if Netflix buy Warner, they will own Batman. And you can be damn sure in 2 years' time, there will be some new serialized Netflix version of Batman. So they are buying legacy products, which they don't really own now. They have things like Bridgerton, but
I love Bridgerton.
Well, there you go. But they don't have that many legacy brands.
Well, I wouldn't consider Bridgerton legacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is going to expand their universe. It's also, in a weird kind of way, possibly going to expand their tech platform, because they'll be taking over something like HBO that they'll already own. And the cynic in, or that they will own, the cynic in you could say, and this is very cynical, and I'm not suggesting they're going to do it, but owning more content, and content's a horrible word in this artistic endeavor, but owning more movies and TV shows, the cynic in you could suggest there is more to AI model, right? That they could start. I'm not suggesting they're going to do it, but the more they own,
but if they did,
the more they can repeat, you know?
Well, at the risk of swinging on the other side of this pendulum, In case I go off track here, but I think it's important to go there. Like, when you look at where Netflix is going, it's not just about streaming. It is, for example, they want to double their ad revenue this year. They want to build out live offerings And games, particularly live sport.
Yeah.
They're also working on a deal with Spotify to integrate high-quality video podcasts.
Yeah.
Are we at risk of missing the overall point here if all we focus on is the streaming side of this deal?
Absolutely we are. And, you know, live events is going to be a huge thing. And you talked about their market share. They really want to get into sport. And I could see a time where they're coming knocking on the Premiership door. Can you imagine that? Like, it would be incredible. And what you have to bear in mind, there's so many things to talk about here, but when they currently own stuff, it doesn't show up anywhere else. So you take, for instance, a show that was on in the States on HBO called All Your Fault. We get to watch that here on Sky, right? So other streamers will sell off stuff for other platforms. Netflix have a strict policy thus far of never doing it. So when Netflix owns something...
like The Crown.
They own it. Yeah, you'll never see The Crown as things stand. So that's their modus operandi. So absolutely they're trying to get into more things. Video games, they're a small part of the plot. They're going to be huge. Live events, but also live events like there have been a couple of things like Chris Rock doing his latest comedy special live. Now, you have to wonder about the logic of that with something like a comedy special. I love Chris Rock. Am I going to stay up till 4 a.m. to watch him live from New York when I can watch it the next day on Netflix? They may start doing live events that they don't show for another 6 weeks. So the future is rich in lots of ways for the consumer. There's a very important caveat here. They are going to certainly own, if they own Warner, there are certain questions to answer about monopolies, you would have to think.
Well, let's get into that, because there are certainly some actors.
Yes.
See what I did there?
Very impressive.
That I want to introduce now into the scene. I won't say that again. But if...
I'm fine with this. Pull away.
Oh, I have plenty more off my sleeve. So first up, the Directors Guild of America said this deal would threaten competition, creative freedom and opportunities for directors and their teams.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
To an extent, but this happens a lot in every business. And Leonard Cohen says the artist makes a mistake when you don't realise commerce and art have to go together. So yes, there is a concern about that. But Hollywood exists in a perma state of chaos, right? Back to the 1940s, there was the studio system when they controlled cinemas and everyone thought this was terrible and actors were in contract. You go up to the 70s, they thought directors had too much power. In the 80s, there was too many blockbuster stars like Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. The advent of TV was meant to ruin Hollywood. The advent of VHS was meant to ruin Hollywood. The advent of streaming was meant to ruin Hollywood. Did it? No, it changed it. This will change it. But it's not going to stop people watching movies and TV shows. They're just going to watch them slightly differently. Now, maybe you're about to ask me this. Is it going to change the cinema experience? Yes. And that's a slight worry. Netflix's modus operandi thus far, for when they make and show movies, it tends to be in the cinema for just 2 weeks. And why do they do that? I hear you ask. Usually because they want to be considered for Oscar contention. So it has to be shown in the cinema. But it tends to only get a 2 week shelf life in the cinema. There's a great new movie out with George Clooney and Adam Sandler called Jay Kelly, who were on Screen Time
last week. I was about to say, yes. Oh, who I believe you interviewed as well.
I went to see that on a Monday a couple of weeks ago. But the place was half empty, unfortunately. And I do worry the effect this is going to have on cinema, and not movies with George Clooney, but movies that, you know, someone has made on a shoestring and word of mouth. And like, will the future Quentin Tarantino suffer as a result of this? Possibly, in that maybe they're not going to make it into a cinema, which breaks my heart, or be in a cinema for a short time. But the important thing is, I think the future Quentin Tarantino will still get to tell stories and have actors and directors and costume makers, but we might change how we watch those, which is a concern, but I think that's the way it's going.
Well, let's enter stage left now. We've got Paramount, because it launched then $108 billion hostile bid to buy it. Now, let me draw a square here. David Ellison is CEO of Paramount.
Yes.
His dad is Larry Ellison, part of the Oracle team. Larry Ellison is a friend of Trump.
Yes.
Trump's son-in-law is a part funder, Jared, is a part funder of the deal from Paramount.
Yeah.
Trump is now weighing in on this decision.
Yeah.
So where do you think this Paramount... Is Paramount worrying about the same things as you are about the future Tarantino?
No.
Or is there something else at play?
Well, Paramount have a streamer now as well. Let's not forget that. And very successful things in their own right, from SpongeBob to all sorts of things, Top Gun and all those kind of things. Trump has spoken out of both sides of his mouth on this, because he's also said, you know,
well, now that isn't often,
that Ted Sarandos is a great guy.
Great
as well.
Guy, yeah.
And he says, this isn't going to go through unless it comes across my table and stuff like that. And yet we have pictures of Ellison and his dad in the White House. So I have no idea how this is going to go. Paramount have said they mounted a hostile takeover because basically no one was returning their calls.
Yes, they said,
seems very strange.
They sent six proposals in 6 weeks and no one took any notice of them.
Exactly. Now, I have no reason to doubt that. But, you know, Paramount are not the great white knight. And no disrespect to Paramount, the idea that they're there to save Warner Cinema. They have a streaming angle as well. This deal from Netflix, Netflix weren't going to take over CNN, which Warner also own as well.
Now that you heard me ask in my head, because I did want to ask you about the politics and the media of that.
Yeah, so like that's very complicated. If why do they not want that? I would suspect the simple reason is it's not going to make them enough money. And Netflix have been, as much as anyone can be in this world, apolitical more or less. Paramount say they want all of it, which will be very interesting. But the thing is, right, so their bid is about 20 billion more than the Netflix one. If they decide this is Warner, that they're not going to accept the Netflix one, they are going to be on the hook for over $2
billion. $2.8 billion, yeah.
Which you would assume that they don't want to do. So I really can't tell you who's going to win this. But it would seem that Netflix and Paramount have equally, I don't want to say benign or malign interest, but it is ultimately about the money, as these massive deals always are. Neither of them are particularly interested in creating future cinema goers, I don't think.
Well, John, I have been wanting to ask you this all year, so I'm going to take my chance.
Okay.
What were the top three things you watched on Netflix this year?
Oh, Four Seasons, which was a terrific TV show. The Beast in Me, which was also a terrific TV show. And I really liked the film J. Kelly. But I'll just say in closing, right, so they were my three top Netflix shows. But we could do the same Disney Plus as well. There was great stuff on as well. But they get unfavorably compared to Spotify. But I come back to this point and I'm hammering it home, but they pay people who tell stories and they will continue to do that. So that's very important to say. If I'm a future musician, I'm a lot more worried about Spotify than if I'm a future movie or TV maker than I am about Netflix. Because Spotify, and I don't think anyone can argue with this, even though they pay, the amount of streams you have to get to make a living as a musician, unless you're in the, I don't want to say Taylor Swift, but you have to be either a legacy artist or CMAT or someone like that, you know. But the guy sitting in his bedsits don't even exist, but you know what I mean. Dreaming of making a movie, I think, has a much fairer chance, crack of the whip, with Netflix than he does with Spotify. Netflix have not cannibalized TV and movies the way Spotify have, I don't think. That's important to say.
And we talked about that when we looked at the economics of audio streaming in that a while ago. It's been a genuine pleasure. You've been worth waiting for while you've been out in the box there, very close by. You haven't been on the microphone with me yet this year. So, John, I want to say, first of all, a huge thank you for today. But
thank
for
you.
Every single week, ever since I began on the show, since Easter Sunday of this year, you're such a genuine joy to work with. And thank you so much for today and always.
Thank you.
John Faraday, presenter of Screen Time, producer of Taking Stock, and as I say, the best film buff that I know. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of, well, Christmas. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for this week's trivia, I ask you if you can guess this US state. It has more mountain peaks than any other mountain state. It's home to the world's first McDonald's drive-thru, and it invented the jet ski. Have a think about that, and I'll tell you at the end of the show. Now, while Christmas is just around the corner, and as consumers around the world brace for what is sure to be yet another costly holiday, purchasing power, of course, does continue to shrink. However, international consumer studies do reveal that customers act quite differently to other times of the year to make the miracle of Christmas happen, even if it means putting finances on the line. Behavioural economist Dr. Emma Howard from TU Dublin joins me today to investigate how different countries are celebrating Christmas, but also how we can make sure that we align our finances with our values around this time of year as well. So first of all, Emma, will you take a trip around the world with me, please? And let's have a look at Christmas across the globe. Like, for me, what comes to mind is, if we look at the US, it starts off in Thanksgiving. And yet, While people spend a fortune there on Christmas, they're back to work much quicker than we are in Europe. I think of German Christmas markets. I think of Sinterklaas in Belgium. What do you think of when you look at Christmas outside of our country?
Yeah, I think like the US and Europe. So I suppose, you know, a lot of it is Christian traditions. So it tends to be very kind of European and US focused. And as you mentioned, like Thanksgiving is actually probably the bigger holiday in the US. And, you know, that brings forward the Christmas spending and probably adds to it over there. But places like the UK and the Netherlands, France and Belgium, you know, right across the EU, there's big spending with some variations in the timing of that and the focus of the celebrations.
And then if we look at Asia, like Christmas itself isn't that much a big deal at all, but yet 80% of the world's Christmas decorations are made there. But on the other hand, Chinese New Year is a big, big deal. And actually, a team member was in Australia for the last couple of weeks and I caught up with her this week since she came back and she said, you know, I was really looking forward to seeing Christmas at home because Christmas in Australia, maybe it's because we connotate it with snow and trees and cold and dark nights, and that's not quite the case over there. So when we look beyond the US and the European continent, what else do we see?
Yeah, I mean, like the as you mentioned, Asia, like they're exporting an awful lot of the things that we're buying at Christmas time. So, you know, if you look at China, like their exports of things like Christmas decorations rising up to about 228 million euros worth. So, you know, there's big export markets for those other countries. Places like Australia, you know, while it might be kind of very alien to us, like they do still have big Christmas celebrations, and you know, in the same way we might hope for snow at Christmas, you know, they'll be down the beach celebrating and they'll be quite used to having their flip-flops on for their Christmas dinner. So a different type of Christmas, but one that they celebrate and that they spend lots of money during as well.
You know, personally, I've never spent Christmas anywhere except Cork, never mind for further afield than that, but we often think Christmas is the way it has always been. And that is because, of course, it's a really traditional time, maybe, or it's a time that is full of ritual and tradition. How do you think that plays into our economic and a microeconomic decision making then? Do we do what we've always done?
Yeah, there's a big and like there's a lot of studies that show when it comes to our willingness to pay for goods, nostalgia plays a big part. So, you know, if we feel nostalgic, if we have those kind of memories and those sentiments from times gone by, that will cause us to spend more money. And, you know, we saw that this year, for example, with the Oasis reunion and, you know, people willing to pay massive prices. And part of that was this sort of, you know, harking back to a time when you might have been younger and freer and so on. So Christmas is full of that. And what marketers are really good at doing is playing on those memories and that nostalgia, but also kind of exploiting our behavioral biases that mean that we don't necessarily kind of look at the cost versus the benefits of spending, but we're sort of biased upwards and we spend a lot more than perhaps we should on goods and on Christmas money, on Christmas activities.
And so let's just hone in on that right at home, because when we look at the latest Credit Union Consumer Index, and this is referring to Christmas 2025, 52% of consumers expect their Christmas spending power this year to be lower in 2025 than a year ago. And that's up from 47%. So more people feel that their money is going less than it was before. And then contrasting this, we have 1 in 10 consumers, so that's 9%, say they'll have more to spend this year compared to last year. One of the defining characteristics of narrative around the particularly US economy this year that I have found, Emma, has been the K-shaped economy. Is this an example of the K-shaped economy in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, like if you look at what's happened to real wages, for example, on average, real wages have been increasing the last year and a half in Ireland. So although we're still seeing cost of living increases, a lot of us are being compensated, more than compensated, for those cost of living increases with wage increases. So for that kind of upper end of the wage distribution, probably their purchasing power is similar or higher than it was last Christmas. But we do have a significant minority who will be left behind and who will be facing very high cost of living increases, particularly because the lower income households spend a much higher proportion of their income on things like food and energy. And those are the items that we're still seeing the highest increases in costs for. So, you know, those households that are on lower incomes are facing much higher cost of living increases than those higher income households.
Well, I was looking at the CSO. The figures were out this Thursday about where inflation now stands. And it was 3.2%. That was how much prices increased between November 24 and November 25. And the pace of price change has increased as well, because in the 12 months to October 2025, it was 2.9%. I wonder, Emma, when people like you and I look at how much people spend at this time of year, we might look at Black Friday sales, we might look at retail spending. Is it the fact that inflation is driving the bus as distinct to people deciding, I would like to spend more or I would like to buy more things? Is that the bigger influence here as distinct to decisions that consumers are making? Is it an involuntary decision?
Yeah, I don't think, like, I know we look at surveys and we see, oh, you know, people are planning to spend a certain amount or this is their Christmas budget this year. But I think when it comes to things like Christmas spending, very few of us, I would say, one, make a budget and two, stick to that budget. And what we tend to do is kind of go with like the norms or we don't think rationally about those spending choices. So, you know, you tend to, rather than kind of evaluating how much of things gone up or how much money do I have to spend, you tend to get referenced by some sort of anchored rather by some sort of a reference point. And that can be like, how much did I spend last year? What do I usually spend? Or it could be, you know, what are others spending? What's the kind of norm level of spending? And so what can happen is you get dragged into, you know, if you're in a family, for example, that buy each other lavish, expensive gifts, that becomes the norm. And then you get kind of sucked into that. So whether or not you can afford it or it's within your budget, you feel that you need to spend that amount. So we can tend then to just overspend and not really think too much about that budget or about that cost of living increase.
I'm interested there when you say that we don't always think about our spending rationally. Are there any biases that kick in, particularly this time of year?
Yeah, there are. There's lots of different biases. So one of them is present bias. And by that, I don't mean the wrapped presents that you'll have underneath the tree. I mean, our tendency to think about immediate rewards more than future rewards or future benefits. So, you know, the whole 'tis the season. Why not? Let's have that extra glass of wine or let's buy that extra present or so on. That present bias results in us making decisions that give us that short-term gain, but we don't think about that credit card bill that's coming at the end of the month, or, you know, maybe that holiday that we have less money to spend on because we've overspent at Christmas. So that's one of those biases that comes in. Framing effects also very much influence our choices. And what can happen is that, you know, marketers understand this. So, you know, you might be willing to pay maybe 2 or 3 euro for a coffee, and you go into a coffee shop and they have a special Christmas coffee and it's 5 euro. And you think, oh, I'd love a festive coffee. And you'll be willing to pay a lot more for that, even though it's probably more or less the same coffee, just perhaps with a bit of cinnamon thrown in or something like that. So yeah, we do tend to be subject to all of these biases, and you know, as we mentioned earlier, that nostalgia effect can cause us to be willing to spend more. So, you know, you want to recreate something from your childhood or some experiences that you enjoyed years ago, and that again causes us to think less about the amount we can afford and increase that willingness to pay.
Well, can I give you a reverse example of what you described there as present bias? I wrote a book in 2013 called The Savvy Woman's Guide to Financial Freedom, but it was out in January. And so I was being asked to write articles in November and like in December this time of year about like my top 10 tips to help people handle the January hangover debt that they were incurring. And I was, it used to break my heart because I was writing how to handle the situation before people had actually created the issue in the first place. And I do wonder, do you think there is more peer pressure, and whether that's WhatsApp groups around what should one get their present, or what should one get their teacher for school, or as you say, the Chris Kindle. How do you break that cycle? How do you do that where you're not the person who wants, you know, who is the killjoy, essentially, but at the same time, the person who could say something that actually creates relief for everyone else there too?
Yeah, and you know what? Like this makes me think of another behavioral concept called pluralistic ignorance, which is where we go along.
Pluralistic ignorance. Wow. Yeah, tell us about this one.
Yeah. So it's where we go along with things because it's the norm, as you say. So, you know, the WhatsApp group, somebody suggests, can we all put in 20 euro for the teacher? And, you know, we'll just pitch in and get a present. And you're thinking, God, 20 euros a lot, you know, and everything's so expensive this year. But you don't want to be, as you say, that killjoy. You don't want to be the person who butts in and says, that's a lot. Could we reduce it a bit this year? But actually, everybody else is thinking pretty much the same thing. So there's this sort of misperception that everyone in the group has a particular opinion or feeling towards it, when actually they don't. And it's the opposite. So often we go along with these norms because we think everybody else is happy with them, but everyone is unhappy with them. So actually, if you go and say, well, do you know what? Is that a bit much this year? Maybe we should reduce it because of the cost of living, etc. You might find that you have about 10 to 15 other people chip in and say, oh God, I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Well, I'm developing my lexicon here at a fierce pace with pluralistic ignorance, present bias, framing effects, but I'm going to throw another one in there as well, which is, in preparation to interview you today, I was reading a piece that was published in the RT that you had written. You quoted a paper by Joel Waldfogel, I hope I have that name correct, who had a theory about the deadweight loss of Christmas presents. And I found that idea intriguing, and it made me think about times that I bought Christmas presents for people. But could you explain what he was saying in that paper and how it might apply to us, and how to fix it, of course, as well?
This is economists being very cheery and festive at their best, talking about the fact that, yeah, oftentimes, you know, it's really inefficient when you think about it. Like, if you, Susan, buy me a present and I buy you a present, neither of us are probably going to get the exact thing that we would have chosen for ourselves. So it would be much more efficient for you just to buy yourself the present and me to buy myself the present. And then, you know, we'd get the exact thing that we value. So this deadweight loss occurs because I buy you a present that is probably, I've paid a lot more for it than you yourself would be willing to pay for that item. And one of the reasons why we tend to do this is because when I'm thinking about what present to buy you, rather than thinking, you know, what would Susan like and what are her interests and, you know, what should I get her? I think about, well, what would I like to get as a present? So we have what's called this egocentricity bias, whereby we kind of falsely believe that people are more like us than they in fact are. And this comes into present buying a lot, where people won't buy something for another person unless they would enjoy that present themselves. And so it means that a lot of the time, you know, we get gifts that even if I like it, maybe you've spent, you know, two or three times on it what I would spend. But then a lot of the time we don't like it and we re-gift or we return, or, you know, worst case scenario, it ends up in the bin or in the wardrobe.
Well, as I'm preparing to buy my mom and my dad and my brother Connor's presents this year, I'm going to have said economist in my mind. That is you, Emma, by the way. Never mind Joel Waldfogel here. It's you I'm going to have in mind, and I'm going to make sure that I avoid an egocentricity bias and ask them, okay, what do you want? And I'll simply pay for it. Really appreciate your time today. It's been a joy to speak to you, Dr. Emma Howard from TU Dublin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And up next, is the single market dead? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Culleton. And I wanted to share a message that I got with you from a listener about the interview I did last week with Connor Pope about health insurance. Declan sent in a message saying, Connor was very clear and really put the case for why we should pay for something when you can get it for free. In our household, with my partner having a background in healthcare, she thinks health insurance is essential, whereas with my background in finance, I can't figure out why we need it. We have an annual ping pong discussion when the renewal comes through, and Connor has strengthened my argument. Thanks a million, Declan, for your message. It's a dream that never really took off. The idea of one big European single market for everything. Yes, there have been numerous treaties and, as we know, many referenda on those treaties, but a single market for goods and services actually has yet to be achieved. So why has it not happened? And why has not having one? What does that mean for the European economy as it seeks to grow? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by two of the senior editors of the Financial Times to discuss this. Henry Foy, Brussels Bureau Chief, is joining me from Brussels, and Ben Hall, Europe Editor, is joining me from London. Now, I read with great interest a piece that you both wrote called Who Killed the Single Market Dream? And you mentioned the French Commission President in 1985 was a driving force. And he was indeed the pioneer of the single European market as we know it today in the first place. So I went back to that time to get a sense of where we were at and to bring us down memory lane. At this point, it was the EEC, of course, and it had Belgium, Denmark, France, West Germany. The Berlin Wall was not going to fall for another 4 years. Greece, Ireland, which was a much smaller economy at the time. Italy, Luxembourg and the Netherlands, as well as the UK. Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister at the time. Spain and Portugal hadn't joined yet. So I'll start with you, Henry. Can I put it to you, first of all, that the EEC, the structure of the institutions, was at a very different place. It was much easier to have vision then with a view to implementation because there was simply less to do in order to make things happen.
Well, I mean, that is one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it, which was the way Jacques Delors looked at it, was we've got this group. It's not really going anywhere. There's quite a lot of stasis. It's a little bit dull. How do we drive forward integration? How do we make countries feel more part of this union? How do we, the EEC as it was at the time, how do we drive innovation and better, closer ties between us? And so he came up with the single market, essentially. And what we have today, certainly in goods, but in the other areas, was the vision of Jacques Delors and was the idea to bring these countries that you just mentioned closer together by trading goods in a free single market. And what our introductory piece and the articles that have followed in this series have tried to explain to readers is that that dream sort of died. Well, it died is a little bit too harsh, but certainly fell to the wayside. Things slowed down. That energy, that drive that Jacques Delors brought to the project and that the countries at the time signed up to has fizzled out. And the problem is, people think it's still a great idea. People think the single market is wonderful, but they're still stuck behind these red lines that they need to cross to drive it to the next level, and certainly to take the single market we see in goods into other areas such as services and capital.
Ben, what do you think was the key architect of that dissipation? Because the energy, let's say, of the 80s, as it moved on then, there was a lot of economic development right across the European continent in the 90s. Obviously, there was several referenda, like I mentioned. We had Lisbon, we had Nice, we had Maastricht. And actually, that's not the correct order either in terms of deeper integration. We had the European Monetary Union. We had the introduction of the euro. Of course, I'm hurtling now into the financial crisis. But I have just brought you through 20 years of developments there from Jacques Delors onwards. What do you think happened during that time frame that either we noticed or we didn't notice that was leading to this?
Well, I think despite the ambitions of FT editors, there was no one person who killed the single market or one reason. It was multiple reasons, essentially. And as Henry said, I mean, it didn't kill the single market project altogether. The single market in goods was more or less completed in the early days, but since then it has just become more fragmented because governments add extra legislation over European legislation, and you get more fragmentation that way. I think there are multiple reasons. One, the European Union is far more complex than it was, and I actually don't think it's about enlargement per se, now 27 members. It's about the fact that the EU is now covers so many aspects of policymaking that essentially policymakers have less of a sense of priority. And I think that's a big problem at the moment, that there isn't an ability to focus on one project over all everything else and to push it through. I think the reality is that Business interests just lost a little bit of interest in the single market because they became more global. I think that's now possibly going in reverse a little bit because of the slowdown in global trade or expected slowdown in global trade, and European businesses are going to have to make more of the internal market for profits and growth, et cetera, et cetera. But I think also rising Euroscepticism, essentially. Governments were less interested in pan-European solutions and giving up decision-making power to Brussels. And I think that applied also to the sphere of the economy above everything else.
Henry, can I pick up there, particularly on the point that Ben makes about the broadening of the scope? Because if I could compare this, or if I could give this analogy, let's say that I'm a founder and I have a 10-person business and I could really be a visionary and I could execute and we could implement and I could be amazing. But if I'm running a 1,000-person organization, those skills or that infrastructure simply wouldn't work. Now I need maybe a C-suite and I need a board, etc. Are the vehicles missing in the European Union now in order to truly execute? If we had a Jacques Delors today, what would he need in order to make it happen?
Well, I think you're right that when Delors came with this idea, they were essentially looking backwards. They were looking at a European economy at that day, and they said, okay, what do we need to trade better? What do you guys care about buying and selling? Of course, the French had a huge agriculture industry. The Germans had a huge industrial industry. There was lots of natural resources that countries wanted to trade. There were things that they had priorities on, and they were able to work that out. What then happened, of course, as the economy developed, rise of financial services, rise of consultancy, rise of technology, all these other parts of the European economy start to develop. And as Ben said, countries were quite unwilling to give Brussels the power to control and regulate those industries. And that's the key part of the single market. You have to have a central regulatory system to make sure this stuff is all being done fairly. And that's where things started to break down. Countries started to say, well, we want to compete with each other on financial services. We want to compete with each other on professional services or whatever it might be. And so therefore, there was a clash in terms of giving up that power. And that's what we're seeing in the Capital Markets Union. For example, there's this huge and long delayed push to try to create some kind of proper single market for capital in the EU to help, as in your example, to help companies grow from 10 people to 1,000 people, to create this sort of this pool of capital that, for example, America or China is able to tap. Europe has this money. It just doesn't share it all. And it's very, very complicated and often very expensive to move it across borders. There are multiple different stock exchanges, multiple different clearinghouses, multiple different rules on bankruptcy and on hiring and firing and all this kind of stuff. There's no capital market, a proper one, inside the EU, and that's what's missing for these companies to grow. So I think to build on Ben's answer and to answer yours, is the countries are not willing to give up the regulatory and the rules control to Brussels for the new and emerging technologies that have come since the late 80s and early 90s. And that's why the single market essentially is stuck where it was when that first burst of enthusiasm and energy came in.
Henry, I'm sighing here silently because the Capital Markets Union is something I've been watching for a long time, and even the subset of it, the Savings and Investment Union, which fundamentally is what you're describing about having the 9 trillion of savings actually accessible to businesses to borrow and lend to and so on like that. So as I'm listening to you, though, what I'm hearing you say is that it's not the European institutions that kill the European single market. It is the constituent parts who say one thing and necessarily might be acting in another direction. And Ben, throughout this year, over and over and over again, when we talk about tariffs, we are typically referring to the US and all the developments that have happened there. However, in your piece, you refer to the fact that obstructions to trade within the EU are equivalent to 100% tariffs for services and a 65% tariff on goods, according to the ECB. How has that manifested itself?
Well, I think they've obviously done the number crunching to figure out why these barriers are so painful for the European economy. And those are the numbers they come up with. You're never going to reduce those numbers to zero because the EU has language barriers and it has national preferences that are never going to go away in the way that they might go away in the United States of America, right? But you can reduce those barriers a lot. And that's essentially what this new renewed drive to complete the single market needs to be about. And just picking up on your last question, the one thing that the single market never had was common rules of operation, if you like, for companies across Europe. So common corporate law, common labour rules, let alone common taxation rules. And that, of course, makes it much more difficult for companies to scale. And that is the thing that they are now beginning to grapple with this idea of a 28th regime, which is a sort of a parallel regime under EU law, where certain companies, it will probably be high growth, scalable, probably tech companies, can apply to establish themselves under. And in theory, those rules would be automatically recognized by every single member state, no ifs, no buts. That is the sort of holy grail. Whether they get there or not is another matter, because there will be a lot of national resistance to that, because some countries will see it as a way of, you know, essentially pulling business away from their own national markets.
Well, let me address the elephant in the room there, because, of course, I think what you might be referring to is the Common Consolidated Corporate Tax Base, the CCCTB, that went nowhere, really. And Ireland was not a big fan of that, as you can imagine. So I see the point. I see the point that if there is a common anything, common taxation system or a common VAT rate or anything else like that, of course, there is a challenge then. But I do also want to just look at the point of what the European Union does well. Like, I mean, Enterprise Europe Network is the biggest business network in the world that's available to businesses. The way in which GDPR has been implemented has been a model that has been, that has worked, first of all, here. In the Draghi report, and we will talk about that, but also Draghi points out how it is one of the best places in the world in terms of social transfers to reduce inequality. Like, there is good here. And the other thing too, I know you mentioned there at the beginning, Henry, that enlargement isn't just about increasing the size of it, but it also is about how the scope has changed. But the EU, and I'm getting this now from EU's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, says the EU could grow as soon as 2030. She's particularly talking about Moldova, Albania, Montenegro. And there's a quote here that says, enlargement is not nice to have, it's a necessity if we want to be a stronger player on the world stage. Chances to enlarge the union do not come often, but this window is open now and we have to use it. So the dream isn't dead. It is still alive, isn't it? And some people still want to access into it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the European single market is a huge, huge draw for any enlargement country. And most of the countries that you've just named there are very clear that the one thing they want first and foremost is access to the single market. It's about jobs. It's about investment. It's about goods and services at a lower price. And you only have to look at what's happened to Poland over the last three decades to see the massive impact that it can have. Poland, the Baltics, and other states that joined in 2004. But the problem is, and this is the part of the enlargement debate that is often overlooked, but is, I would argue, more important than the reform debate in the enlargement countries itself, is how the EU reforms itself prior to that enlargement wave. And there are lots of voices here in Brussels saying, if we just take in another two, three, four countries and sort of try and bolt them on to this already quite unwieldy, quite a fractured business environment, and as Ben said, with all these multiple different rules on taxation, on hiring and firing, on labor laws, it's not going to make it better. It's going to make it worse. And so what we need to do is fix lots of aspects of the EU, one of which being the single market, make it more streamlined, make it more unified, make it, in the vision of Delors' original idea, more cooperative around the new areas that we've seen post-1985 in services and others. And then when the countries are ready to join, they'll adopt those new rules and they'll be ready to go. And we'll have a much more efficient single market. And to your point about the benefits of the EU, of course, social transfers, inequality, Mario Draghi has been very, very clear that if we don't fix the EU economy, we don't improve the single market and improve competitiveness, we will not be able to raise the tax in the future that is required to keep that social way of life in Europe going. And the ECB has made the same point, so that there are, that these things are all linked. If we want to keep Europe as a wonderful place to live, we need the economy to keep moving too.
Ben, over and over and over this year, and in fact last year, I've heard the Draghi report, and Henry, you're spot on in everything that you're saying that is related to it. He says if we don't drive on, particularly in digitalization, decarbonization, we lose a lot of ground to China and the US. However, if we then look at the single market strategy, Ursula von der Leyen starts off with that, and this was only published in June of this year. She said GDP is 18 trillion. We have a market of 450 million people, 26 million businesses. The EU has created 3.6 million jobs. And in that strategy, she highlights the problems, not she, the whole, the body of work highlights the problems. So if we know what the problems are, is it just that national governments don't necessarily want to drive on with more integration? Or is there something else? Like, if we know what the problems are, can we not just go on and do it?
No, I think you put your finger on the problem. We know what the problems are, and we actually know what the kind of policy solutions are. And in a way, that was what we wanted to try and convey in this series of FT articles. These are political impediments to further deepening these markets in goods and services, and even in labour and capital. It's an unwillingness to give up power. That's one thing. And I think another thing that you should mention is that there is a sort of resistance to market disciplines that we didn't perhaps have in the 1980s, when there was a desire to liberalize and to free up growth and to free up companies. And I think that has also been lost to a certain degree in recent decades. And you can see that in particular in countries like France, where there is a lot of resistance to internal competition within the EU single market. You can see that on a sort of day-to-day level. The French don't like the fact that, or French farmers certainly don't like the fact that cheap Spanish nectarines come into the country, and that this is something to be resisted. Actually, that's what the single market is all about, is about efficiencies. And through efficiencies and greater productivity, you get higher standards of living and higher wages. But that is, it's sort of like Europe has to revisit its fundamentals. And I think there is a beginning, I think more and more governments understand that. But then you need to translate that into a real action. And that really requires leadership from Brussels, but also the big capitals. And at the moment, we're not really seeing that.
Well, if we were to really get into the nuances of the French interaction with itself, as well as the European body, we would need an awful lot more time. It has been really insightful to speak to you both. Thank you both for joining us here on Taking Stock, and best wishes with the remainder of the series. I will be watching closely. Thank you very much to Henry Foy, Brussels Bureau Chief, and Ben Hall, Europe Editor at the Financial Times.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, for the answer to my trivia. At the beginning of the show, I asked if you could work out this US state based on these three clues. It has more mountain peaks than any other mountain state, is home to the world's first McDonald's drive-thru, and it invented the jet ski. Well, the answer is Arizona. And the reason that I picked it this week is actually quite a poignant one, because this week, 2 years ago, my cousin Philip, who was living in Arizona, left us, and it was my first and only cousin that has passed away in my tight-knit family. So it is fitting that my trivia gives a nod to him rather than my own travels this week. And rest in peace, Phil. So I'll just remind you that this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And of course, he was a guest as well this week. And on research was Stephen Daunt and Tessa Njoku. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And next week, we're going to have a special show where I'll be talking to some of the friends of our show about the best business or economics books that they've read all year. Talk to you then.